Professor Lewis Wolpert. Since 1966, he's been head of the Department of Biology as applied to medicine. Applied to medicine, first at the Middlesex Hospital Medical School, and then that I think has become part of the University College Hospital Medical School. He's a Fellow of the Royal Society of nearly 25 years standing, and was for 5 years Chairman of their Scientific Information Committee. He's also Chairman of the Committee for the Public Understanding of Science. He's published several books, including one with the intriguing title, as it seemed to me, of The Unnatural Nature of Science. And he's presented a number of programs, there it is, number of programs on Radio 3 and on BBC 2. You may remember about 5 years ago a series of three programs called A Living Hell, which was based on his book Malignant Sadness, The Anatomy of Depression. And his name, I'm sure, will be well known to many of you. And on my left is Rupert Sheldrake. Rupert is a biologist. He was Director of Studies in Biochemistry at Care College, Cambridge, for 6 years, and a Research Fellow of the Royal Society. For 4 years, he was Principal Plant Physiologist at Hyderabad in India, where he worked on the physiology of crops for the semi-arid conditions one finds in a lot of India, and I think made a notable contribution to the ability of India to feed its population, which is now over a billion. He's published more than 50 papers in scientific journals and has also written a number of books, of which the best known is probably Seven Experiments That Could Change the World, which was voted Book of the Year in 1994 by the British Institute for Social Inventions. Programme for this evening, and I'll try to keep to the timings, Liz has already given an indication. Professor Wolpert is going to speak first for 15 minutes. He says that's all he needs. He has obviously confidence. Rupert Sheldrake's then going to have half an hour to summarise some of the evidence for the existence of telepathy. Lewis will then have 10 minutes in which he'll subject the evidence to, shall I say, critical review, and Rupert Sheldrake will have 10 minutes to respond. And that should take us to about 7:40, as I say, I'll try and keep to the timing. Debate will then be thrown open to the floor for half an hour, after which our two principal speakers will have 5 minutes each to state their final position. After the debate concludes, as Liz says, you're all invited to drinks in the vaults below, where there'll be a pay bar. If you haven't visited the vaults, I do recommend that you do so. This building was built in the 1770s, and the brick vaults down at the basement are really something worth seeing. They've been fairly recently refurbished. They're quite a spectacular example of brick vaulting. There'll be a pay bar there, and you can go on discussing the subject till 10 o'clock when the evening will close. Before I ask Professor Wolpert to open the debate, I think it'd be of interest to take a show of hands on the question whether you believe in the existence of telepathy or not, and or whether you start this evening with an open mind. So what I'm proposed to do is to ask those who believe that telepathic communication between human beings or between human beings and animals is possible or capable of taking place, please signify by raising a hand.
Oh dear.
Well, it's not everyone by a long way. Right, that's enough. With those who don't believe it is capable of taking place, please raise a hand. Oh, Lewis, you're a little bit outnumbered. And those who have an open mind on the matter? Well, there's a few people who have come with open minds. We'll try that again at the end of the evening and see if anybody's changed their mind. I'll ask Professor Wolpert to open the debate, and we've stuck to the time so far. 15 minutes is about...
Can I do it from here? Is
I think it's quite convenient to do it from here.
Yes, it is.
The spotlights.
Absolutely. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. I'm the boring speaker. Rupert will tell you something more interesting. I am absolutely amazed, A, that so many of you have come, and so many of you actually believe in telepathy. It's fascinating. I'm writing a book on belief, but I'm not going to talk about that now. So let me try and explain to you my position with regard to telepathy and other paranormal phenomena. I think it would be very, very, very exciting if it were true. You know, it would open up, and I think Rupert's made that point, that if any of these phenomena, let's say if angels existed, I think that would be absolutely wonderful. If there were really fairies at the bottom of the garden, how exciting that would be. If really thoughts could go from one person to another, this would be a totally new phenomenon, and it would really be extremely exciting. And I suppose the line that I take, and it's a boring line, I must admit, is that the very nature of science is based on evidence. And the blunt fact is, there is none that's persuasive. Now, it could be that the Queen is a Russian spy. Is it a possibility? Yes. The evidence is not very good, I don't think. I think you would agree with me. That there are ghosts, I know, I have very close friends who have seen ghosts, there's no question about it whatsoever. That does not mean that, although she's seen ghosts, doesn't mean to say they actually exist. And I suppose the position that I take with regard to telepathy and all these paranormal phenomena is that it would be wonderful if they were true, but there ain't the evidence to support them. Zero reliable evidence. And let me tell you what I mean. Now, one way of looking at this whole phenomenon is based on an idea of a famous chemist called Irving Langmuir. He was a very distinguished chemist who coined the term pathological science. And what he meant by pathological science is that this kind of science focuses on a number of phenomena which are totally startling. The effect observed is always very small. It's near the limit of detectability. The magnitude of the effect seems independent of anything that you can actually think of. It's usually a fantastic theory. And when there are criticisms of the experiments, there are always ad hoc explanations as to why they actually occur. And I think in relation to telepathy, I've looked at the literature on this, there is not a single example in the whole of the scientific literature which gives reliable support to telepathy. I'll repeat myself in case you did not hear me clearly. There is not in the whole of the scientific literature, properly refereed in proper journals like the British Journal of Psychology, a single paper that is persuasive with regard to the ability of thoughts to be transferred. And that's not terribly surprising. I cannot say it's impossible. You see, Richard Feynman, very, very famous physicist, was once asked if he believed in flying saucers. And Feynman said no. And the person said, but that's very bad science. What's your evidence that they don't exist? He said, I don't have evidence that they don't exist. That's my gut feeling. And I'm terribly sorry. The evidence for them is extremely poor. Now, please don't misunderstand me. The fact that the evidence is poor does not mean to say it doesn't exist. And there are many examples in history of science where the evidence was very poor, and yet, it turned out to be right. One of the best examples, he said, quoting from his own book, is, of course, continental drift. If you remember Alfred Wegener, a very distinguished German geologist, believed that the continents had drifted apart, and that's why South America looked as though it fitted with Africa quite nicely. Nobody believed him at all. They thought he were crazy. The physicists said, I've never heard such rubbish. And then eventually, evidence did appear, and he turned out to be right. The very grand Lord Kelvin, one of the greatest physicists ever, had really false ideas about the age of the earth. That's because his ideas about temperature were wrong. He didn't know about radioactivity. So scientists can be very, very against ideas and then eventually turn out to be wrong themselves. And one of the nicest examples, and I love it, is Newton himself. When Newton put forward his ideas about gravity, can I remind you what Leibniz said? That is, any two bodies have an attractive force between them. You may not believe it, sir, but you and I attract each other. as do the rest of the audience. This glass is attracted to each other by a force proportional to their masses and inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them. And when this happened, Leibniz, the great German scientist, said, "A senseless occult quality that it can never be cleared up, even though a spirit, not to say God himself, were endeavoring to explain it." Newton said, "Look, you know, it's difficult." And Leibniz, "It is inconceivable that inanimate brute matter would, without modification of something else which is not material, operate and affect other matter without material contact." And he goes on to say, and I'm not going to give you the whole of quotation, "It's so great an absurdity that I believe no man who has a philosophical matter can really fall into it, but gravity must be caused by an agent, because this is what the evidence shows." So it's really, the whole issue is about evidence. Now, I don't think any of you would really wish to deny that bodies, we still don't really understand gravity as far as I understand, that bodies, you know, you and I are attracted by our weights, you more than me, you're heavier than I am. Attraction is mutual. It is absolutely astonishing. And when you get down to remarkable things like quantum mechanics, it really is astonishing in every possible sort of way. But you have to be careful. There have been many claims, and one of the most famous claims was, if you remember, the famous case of Benveniste, who published a paper in Nature saying that although a particular substance had been diluted so much that there were no molecules left in the water, it could still have an effect, and that the memory was held in the water, it was shown to be false. And so once again, the whole issue is that of evidence. And I just, you know, all I can say is that looking at the literature and listening to Irving Langmuir's point that all the studies in relation to extrasensory perception and telepathy fall beautifully into the category of pathological science. Very small effect, unrepeatable, lots of excuses why people can't repeat them. And of course, it goes against one's intuition that the idea that something going on in one's brain, any biologist or physicist who thinks about it would say it's extremely implausible. That doesn't mean to say it's not true. As I keep telling you, there have been many cases in science where things were thought to be untrue and turned out to be right. Why do people believe in these things? Well, there are many coincidences. You know, you often get a phone call and you think, gosh, I was just thinking of... I've got a friend, Pat Williams. Is Pat in the audience? Pat, often when she phones me, there you are. quite often she would claim that she knows when I'm about to phone her. But coincidences happen, and that's not the issue. I think a lot of the confusion comes from what I'm going to call the Clever Hunts confusion. Let me tell you about Clever Hunts. It goes back over 100 years. There was a Russian aristocrat called William von Osten who was very keen to show that animals were very much cleverer than people thought. He bought a horse whom he trained to solve mathematical problems by tapping with his foot. And he traveled the world with this horse, Clever Hunts, showing how clever this animal was. Oh, it was very, very, very impressive. But then came along a scientist called Oscar Pfungst who said, "Look, this is very weird. I'm going to design a series of tests to see whether Hunts is as clever as I thought." And when he gave Hunts a set of questions to which von Osten didn't know the answer, yes, the horse did very badly. And what it turned out then is if he put on blinkers on the horse, so that when the slate was shown to the horse and he was asked to tap, very bad news. And what it turned out is that this horse had learned to look at von Osten's head, which would move very slightly, or just, do you see my eyebrows raising? Horses are very good at eyebrows, apparently. And this is how clever Hans knew how to think. I think you have, with these experiments, to be very, very, very careful about experimental error, the influence of the experimenter. And I've done it in less, I've done it in 10 minutes, 35 seconds, 36 seconds. My line is really quite simple. There is zero evidence to support the idea that thoughts can be transmitted from a person to an animal, from an animal to a person, from a person to a person, or from an animal to an animal. Thank you very much.
Well, that's admirably brief and puts us a little bit ahead of the clock. Rupert, you have half an hour now to produce evidence that will produce a little persuade, if not Professor Walters, those who have open lines.
Thank you. Well, Lewis Wolpert and I agree on one thing, which is that we think the nature of science is based on evidence. He thinks there's no persuasive evidence for telepathy. Of course, that depends on how easy it is to persuade somebody. There are many creationists who think there's no persuasive evidence for evolution. If you have a closed mind and if you're convinced you're right, then no amount of evidence will make the slightest difference. And I think that the question really is, what is the evidence for telepathy? And that's what I'm going to talk about. I myself think there's a lot of persuasive evidence for telepathy. And I think that the experiments that have been done to test it have been far from pathological. They've been done largely by people who've had no grants. They've had every kind of adversity placed in their way. They're not people within the scientific establishment quite often. And this, I think it's more like heroic science than pathological. Anyway, the evidence, I think, falls into several categories. For me, the most persuasive and important evidence is the fact that so many people believe they've actually had telepathic experiences. Most people, indeed, according to surveys in Britain, Europe, America, and all around the world, believe they've had these experiences. Now, some might say, and in fact, Lewis Wolpert would say, that this is in fact an illusion, that they've had, there have been coincidences, and they've wrongly believed these to be telepathic. Tricks of memory, forgetting when they're wrong, only remembering when they're right, and so forth. But the fact is that millions, hundreds of millions, in fact billions of perfectly normal, rational people believe that they've had these experiences. Can they all be wrong, and so easily deluded? Secondly, there have been many collections of case histories, stories of people's telepathic experiences. These are generally dismissed in their entirety as being anecdotal. An anecdote is by definition an unpublished story. In Greek, an means not, ekdotos means published. Many branches of science are based on experience. It's the starting point for science. It's not something we can reject. And there have been many collections of case histories, and if you collect hundreds of anecdotes, lots of people have had similar experiences, anecdotes turn into a kind of natural history. I have databases myself with more than 5,000 case histories, and you hear the same story over and over again. It may be only a case history of what people believe, and believe falsely, but nevertheless, there is a huge amount of this kind of evidence. But from a scientific point of view, in order to rule out the obvious objection that's been raised right from the beginning of research on telepathy, that it's just a matter of coincidence, then you have to do experiments where you can actually estimate the probability of coincidence. And in the 1880s, with the founding of the Society for Psychical Research, statistical methods were applied to this research, starting with the great physicist William Barrett. In fact, this was one of the first areas of science where statistics were actually used in experimental research. Psychical research actually paved the way for a lot of subsequent science. the statistical evidence is important because the only way you can tell if something's a chance coincidence is if you know what the expected level of chance is. And so you can actually compare what occurs with what you'd expect by chance. I'm going to talk now mainly about experimental research on telepathy. And the classical forms of this come in four kinds. The first kind was the card-guessing experiments that were pioneered by Sir William Barrett. And this is based on a recent review of all this early literature. There were 186 published papers describing 3,600,000 trials. These combined together give the results you see these are papers published in journals. There's 186 published papers, more than 30 investigators. The statistical significance is astronomical. This P is 1 times 10 to the minus 21. You can express in this form as the odds against chance, of this cumulative result being due to chance. This is based on a technique widely used in medicine called meta-analysis, where you combine the results of many different studies. It's the basis on which clinical efficacy by the Institute of Clinical Excellence is judged. It's a pretty standard technique in science. And it enables you to combine different kinds of data. Anyway, that's the effect of these combining together all these papers. The effect is repeatable. It's true in this case the card guessing things produce a rather small effect, but when you have a small effect repeated over hundreds of thousands, in this case millions of times, it becomes very significant. The second kind of research on telepathy was of the transmission of drawings. Many people did tests where one person would draw a picture and another person in another room or in another city would try to draw what they were drawing. There were spectacular successes with this research. The best known summary of it is by the American writer Upton Sinclair, who published a book called Mental Radio in 1930. It was a great bestseller. It's hard to quantify the similarities, even though they're very striking, and so that hasn't been generally pursued by parapsychologists. In the 1960s, a new line of research was started in experimental parapsychology involving tests on dream telepathy. Many people have telepathic experiences in dreams, and in these experiments, people went to sleep in a laboratory. When they started dreaming, which was measured by rapid eye movements, an experimenter in a different building or quite remote from the dreamer looked at a randomly chosen picture and concentrated on it to see if they could transmit that image to the dreamer. These experiments gave positive and highly significant results when taken together. I'm going to show you the results, a meta-analysis of the dream telepathy data, which went on between 1966 and 73. 25 published studies in peer-reviewed scientific journals, 450 trials, statistical significance 1.3 times 10 to the minus 8, or if you like, 75 million to 1 against chance. And here are the results of the individual studies. These are error bars at the 95% confidence limit. Here's the chance level here. Some of them were indeed below chance, some were at chance, but many were above chance, and if you combine them all using standard statistical techniques, this is the result here, with an error bar that's showing it's significantly above chance. It's not true that these are not repeatable. Many of them were repeatable. There were certainly a few that didn't follow the general pattern. This is very common in science. It's certainly the case in many medical trials, which is why people use this technique. Very few people's experiments work the same way every single time. Maybe they do in school classrooms, but in real science at the research frontiers, it's more messy, and this is the kind of thing that's quite normal in many fields of science. Then there was a development of a new kind of experiment, the Ganstelt telepathy tests, which have been going on since the 70s in parapsychology labs. In these tests, the subject lies in a room in a state of mild sensory deprivation with half ping pong balls over the eyes, white noise through earphones, a red light, relaxed conditions. while somebody in another room or another building looks at a photograph or a video clip selected at random from a pool of photos or videos, and then the question is, can the person identify out of four possible pictures that they're shown at the end, which was the one the person was looking at? If they were just guessing, the success rate would be 25%. Well, the Gantzfeldt experiments conducted between 1974 and 85 were reviewed in 1985. With this result, 25 published studies, 762 trials, overall statistical significance, you'll see here, it's, 1,000 billion to 1. Here are the results of the individual trials. Again, like the dream telepathy ones, there were some that were negative, and sometimes skeptics say, oh, it's totally unrepeatable, so-and-so got a negative result. True. But if you look at the whole picture, the overall significance is given here, and you see this is above the chance level. Again, it's a fairly small effect, but it's nevertheless a clear one. If you're looking at the effects of aspirin in preventing heart attack, you're looking at effects much smaller than this, and yet these are medically recommended procedures. These were then repeated. In 1985, these were reviewed by a number of people who call themselves informed skeptics. That's people who actually study these experiments. And they made a number of criticisms, admitting that the effect was there, something was going on. But they put forward a number of criticisms that parapsychologists then tried to meet. By automating the procedure and ruling out various things that could have led to leakage of information. Of course, the clever hands effect has been known right from the beginning of parapsychology, and all these things are done in separate rooms, so there's no possibility of subtle cues. All these experiments are subject to intense scrutiny by extremely hostile and implacable skeptics who are eager to pounce on any flaw. This is probably the most rigorous and heavily monitored field of research in the whole of science. Skeptics identified a few possible flaws, and by taking this into account, the auto-Gantzfeldt telepathy tests were done. When reviewed in 1997, they gave this result. 176 laboratories, more than nearly 2,000 trials, that's the significance. Here are the detailed studies, and there's the combined result. This includes the first up to 1985 tests. The 10 most recent tests on the Gantzfeldt, in a review published in 2001, show, again, a significant effect, not as big, but still showing big odds against chance. Well, although I think this kind of evidence collected by parapsychologists from research in laboratories is quite impressive, indeed persuasive, it does have one big disadvantage, that they're based on extremely artificial situations. In an attempt to be scientific, many of these experiments have moved very far away from telepathy in real life. And in particular, in real life, telepathy most commonly occurs between people who know each other well. It typically happens between partners, spouses, mothers and children, twins, best friends, sometimes between therapists and clients if there's an emotional bond, transference, and so on. It doesn't happen between strangers in the real world, or at least if it does, it's very rare. Yet, in these laboratory experiments, what they typically did was got a couple of strangers, usually students in the lunch hour, to guess meaningless cards selected for lack of emotional significance in separate rooms. What surprises me is that they did get such positive results. I personally wouldn't have expected the results to be as positive as the ones we've seen, because the conditions for telepathy are so poor. In some ways, I think parapsychologists have shot themselves in the foot by working under such totally unnatural conditions, so far removed from the real world. However, there have been many experimental studies of telepathy under much more natural conditions. And one that I particularly like, in fact, is one of the very first I ever read, was done by Sir Rudolf Peters, who was professor of biochemistry at Oxford. Then he moved to Cambridge, and I knew him when I worked in the biochemistry department at Cambridge. One day in the lab tea room, the subject of telepathy came up, and at that time I was a standard knee-jerk skeptic. And I said, oh, it's rubbish, it's all coincidence and delusion and so forth. And Sir Rudolph, who was a very intelligent and charming fellow, said, well, I'm not so sure. He said, I've been looking into a case that a friend of mine found, and he told me about it. It was a mother who lived in Cambridge with a severely mentally retarded son. It came to Sir Rudolph's attention through a friend of his who was an ophthalmologist. This boy had very poor vision. When he tested his eyes, he found the boy was getting brilliant results on the eye tests, and he couldn't understand it. He then sent the mother out of the room, and the boy's scores went way down. He couldn't do it without his mother. They then did other tests, and they found that this boy could get all sorts of things right if his mother was there. And of course, they thought, well, this must be the clever Hans effect. So then had the mother in a separate room, and it still worked. They then did a controlled series of experiments from laboratories in Cambridge to laboratories in Babraham, which is about 5 miles from Cambridge, where the mother was shown a series of cards with numbers or letters on them in a random sequence. And at the other end of the phone, the boy was told when the trial began, and then he had to guess what the card or what the number or the letter was. The whole thing was tape recorded as well, in case anyone could have argued there were subtle cues going over the telephone. The results of those trials were very different from the normal laboratory parapsychology trials. These, in the 479 trials involving numbers, the chance expectation with numbers from 1 to 10 is getting it right 10% of the time. He was actually right 32% of the time. The significance is there, 1 times 10 to the minus 27. And with letters, 163 trials, chance expectation was 4% because there are 26 letters. Actual success rate 32%, 10 to the minus 75. Well, these are staggeringly significant results, much more impressive than the standard laboratory parapsychology. This is not an isolated example. The psychical research literature is full of studies of this kind. No one has ever flawed this study. They've simply ignored it. And Sir Rudolph Peters was very eager for, when he told me about it, he's published in a peer-reviewed journal. He said, would you like to listen to the tapes, see if you can detect any background noise? I did listen to them. I couldn't, there was absolutely no sign of it. It was examined by professional conjurers and magicians. No one could find a flaw in it. So what happened to it? It subsided into the obscurity that most research in this subject does, because it just doesn't make it into the mainstream scientific literature because it's a taboo area. Anyway, that's an example of a study that I think shows quite clear-cut results. I myself have been doing research in areas which are closer to real-life phenomena. Through collecting large numbers of case histories and doing surveys, I've been trying to identify which are the commonest areas where people have telepathic experiences, and then trying to design experiments to test them under real life or as close to real life conditions as possible. One very common claim is that mothers are often telepathic with their babies, and some nursing mothers claim that they're physiologically telepathic in the sense that their milk lets down, their nipples start leaking if they're away from the baby, maybe shopping in a supermarket, when the baby needs them. This has never been investigated scientifically. And so I set up a controlled study where we monitored milk letdown in 9 nursing mothers over a 2-month period. We found out exactly when their milk let down and also monitored when the baby woke up. They were miles apart. And to see whether the milk let down correlated with the baby's waking up. It did. Well, they weren't always right, but the odds against it being a chance coincidence were 1 billion to 1. Then you might think, well, then it's just synchronized rhythms. Well, it wasn't. They didn't follow a particular pattern, but if you analyze the statistics to eliminate any possible rhythm, you still get a highly significant effect. Many mothers claim to have experienced it. The data show that it seems to be happening. So more studies are no doubt needed, but here's a case where real-life telepathy does seem to correlate with what happens. Probably the commonest kind of apparent telepathy in the modern world is telepathy in connection with telephone calls, as Lewis Wolpert has already mentioned. And the usual response to this is exactly what he said. Oh, it's just a coincidence. You remember when you're right, you forget the millions of times you're wrong, and there's nothing in it. I've done surveys that show this is the commonest, by far the commonest kind of telepathy in the modern world. The surveys show that in an average population, about 80% of people claim to have had the experience of thinking of someone who then rings in a seemingly telepathic way, or ringing someone who says, "That's funny, I was just thinking about you." How many people here, as a matter of interest, have had that sort of experience with phone calls? Well, yes, I would say that's about close to the national average. Now, can we dismiss it as easily? This easy armchair argument that's ruled the roost in science for 100 years since telephones were invented has not a shred of evidence in its favour. No one has ever done the tests. Now, it's very good to put forward a hypothesis, but in science, putting forward a hypothesis is not enough. You need to test it. And there are very few areas of science where people can put forward a hypothesis with no evidence at all and achieve universal assent within the scientific community. This is one of those pathological areas of regular science, I think, where there's a denial of evidence, a blindness to evidence, and, in fact, a willful ignorance. Can you actually test it, though? Can we take it further than mere armchair arguments? The answer is yes. You can do experiments on telephone telepathy, and I've now done, with the help of my colleague Pam Smart, who's here this evening, over 800 of these tests. How the experiments work is as follows. We find people who say this happens to them. We ask them to name 4 people it might happen with. They're usually close friends or family members. And then they sit at home. They're filmed, the phone's on the table in front of them, a landline, because of course all mobile phones have caller ID displays, and they know they'll get a call at around, say, 10 o'clock. At around 10 o'clock the phone rings. It's one of those 4 people. Before they pick it up, they have to guess who. They can't know by rational means, because we picked that person 10 minutes earlier by the throw of a die, at random. So it's a randomized design. The person is miles away. There's no clever hands effect of noticing nods of the head or anything like that. Just the phone ringing, they have to guess who. By chance, they'd be right one time in 4, 25%. In fact, the average success rate is way, way above chance. Results here of our experiments are shown summarized on this sheet. We did, our original experiments were not filmed, and they were possibly open to cheating. We had 63 subjects, so they're less rigorous than the other ones. But here the chance expectation is 25%, the actual results 40%, significance 4 times 10 to the minus 16. This is a massively significant result. Of course we need to rule out cheating, which is why we then moved on to the filmed version of this. And the results of those experiments are shown here. The scores were actually higher in the filmed experiments than the unfilmed ones, 45%, 10 to the minus 12 significance. So these experiments have given dramatic results. They've now been replicated at 2 other universities, Cape Town and Amsterdam. And a version of this was shown on television a few months ago, where the television company did it with five people. They chose the Nolan Sisters, a 1980s pop group, because they thought if you're going to do an experiment on television, it's got to be with celebrities. Well, the Nolan Sisters did fine. Their success rate was 50%, statistically significant. And this was shown on Channel 5 television. Some of you probably saw it. Well, now, telephone telepathy, it's fairly easy to do these experiments. They make great school projects. But what I'm now doing is experiments on email telepathy. This is a similar phenomenon. Many people have said they think of someone, then get an email from them. Is this just coincidence? Well, how do we? The only way to find out is to do a test. We have the same design, 4 potential emailers. They're selected at random. You know you'll get one at a fixed time. Just before that, you have to guess who it's going to be. 25% is the chance expectation. With 50 participants in unfilmed experiments, the success rate was 40%, similar to the telephone telepathy, highly significant. With 5 participants in filmed experiments, the success rate is 46%, again, massively significant. With the help of Mike Lambert, this has now been put into an automated form on the internet. And you can carry out this experiment yourself by going to my website. You can do 10 trials in less than 20 minutes. All you need to have is some friends willing to be online at the same time. So this kind of research can now be tested by anyone. You don't need to take my word for it. Now, I want to talk now in the remaining time on animal telepathy. This is extremely common. Many people have had telepathic experiences with dogs and cats. With Pam Smart, we've done hundreds of experiments, filmed experiments on dogs that know when their owners are coming home. They go and wait at a door or window when the owner's on the way home. And we've shown that this happens even when people come at random times. It's all filmed, it's objectively evaluated, it happens when they travel by taxis. It's not a chance effect, it's highly significant statistically, and it's been replicated rather unwillingly by skeptics eager to debunk it. They got exactly the same results. I don't have time to show those owing to the limitation of time, because I want to talk now about some experiments that are going on at present with a psychic parrot that lives in New York. The owner of this parrot found that it picked up her thoughts. It seemed to know what she was thinking. It has a vocabulary of 950 words currently. It's the most accomplished language-using animal in the world. It's now been shown that parrots can use language meaningfully. This parrot speaks in sentences. And it picks up her thoughts. It even interrupts her dreams when it sleeps beside her bed. It wakes her up from dreams by commenting on what she's dreaming about. Now, when I first heard this, of course, I didn't believe it. I thought this was off the end of the scale of anything I've done before. I went to visit her in Manhattan, New York, where she lives. We did some simple tests where I got her looking at pictures in a different room, and the parrot said what she was looking at. I couldn't see any conceivable means of trickery. So we set up a filmed experiment where we had a whole series of sealed images in sealed envelopes, and the images were in a random order. She opened them in one room on camera. In another room, the parrot, with no one else there, was in a separate floor, was filmed all the time. The transcripts were done independently to see whether it said what she was looking at. The success rate was staggering. In 71 trials, it was right 23 times, 32%. There were 19 possible words. This result was hugely above chance, and I'm now going to show you a video that gives you the feel of this particular experiment. Well, I've run out of time, so I'm afraid I can't go into more details on that, but I should just say that this these experiments have been evaluated and transcribed independently by three different people. The statistics have been done by an independent statistician, a professor of statistics in Amsterdam. And it's all been written up and published in a peer-reviewed journal. In fact, came out today in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. I've brought copies of papers on the videotaped experiments on telephone telepathy, the filmed experiments on a dog that knows when its owner's coming home, and this one, which will be available afterwards. There aren't enough for everyone, but if any of you are particularly interested in the technical details, you can read them there at your leisure. Well, I've run out of time, and there's a great deal more I could have said, but I hope I've said enough to show that there's actually rather a lot of evidence for telepathy. It may not persuade people who don't want to believe in telepathy or convinced it's impossible, because by definition, any evidence must be flawed, fraudulent, or whatever. For many people who are more open-minded, I think there's a great deal here to engage with, and I think what we see here is normal science working under rather adverse conditions, but working normally through hypothesis, through testing, through evidence, through criticism, through improved techniques, and so on. And so I just end by saying it again. I think there's a lot of evidence for telepathy of various kinds, including experimental evidence under controlled conditions.
Before I invite contributions to the floor, we'll give Lewis Wolpert an opportunity to review critically what he's heard.
Well, it's hard to review critically without going into each case separately. I suppose, as a scientist, it's slightly weird that what the people who work in this field is just to provide more examples. They make no effort whatsoever to understand what's going on. You see, any normal scientist would say, let's take our best example for telepathy. Let's say it's the phone. Now let's try and understand what's going on there. For example, how does it vary with distance, for example? What happens if I actually cheat? And none of the people are the people I've told. Will the people at the other end know? In other words, try to falsify the hypothesis. It ain't like that. And you see, my difficult, Rupert, is from the papers I have in front of me. I have in front of me a paper by Richard Wiseman, Matthew Smith, and Julie Milton, actually done with your dog, or sorry, no, Pam Smart, who's your collaborator, with your dog JT, which you claimed knew when you were coming home. And their analysis of the behavior of the dog JT shows that the dog didn't have a clue. It would go outside for all sorts of reasons. And, you know, there was somebody passing by, there was a cat in a nearby tree, didn't have a clue when you were coming home. So here is the people trying to replicate your experiment and simply falsifying it. Now, I'm sorry, I do not work in this field, but that's the sort of problem that we scientists... I have another paper here by Julie Milton and Richard Wiseman, which is a meta-analysis of mass media tests of extrasensory perception. A meta-analysis is sort of the thing that Rupert's been talking about, looking, you know, at all the studies. And what this of representing 1 point... We like using big numbers, it's showing off. 1.5 million trials. The analysis shows there's nothing there. Now, the only way, of course, to resolve this is for people to sit down and look at these things. See, I think you must understand that if telepathy were really there, the neuroscience would be begoggled, bedazzled. They'd work on it like a shot. It would be exciting beyond words. Scientists aren't as dim as you may think they are. You know, if there's a new... If you take my own field, for example, we're so bogged down in detail, you could die of boredom on occasion. I really mean it. You know, it's technical. To find a new phenomenon where you can open up a whole new world, you jump on it like a shot. Why haven't they done so? Simply, there isn't a good experimental system which gives you reliable results. I know Rupert's given you all these figures with hundreds of millions of odds against chance. The only way would be to try and repeat those experiments by other people. And I think when, for example, Rupert wants to go for personal anecdote, I'm terribly sorry, I don't take personal anecdotes seriously. Sorry, that's not the way science works. Sorry, you actually think... Let me give you one of your personal anecdotes. Do you think there's a... When you're at 400 miles an hour in an aeroplane, do you think there's a force pushing you forward? Yes or no? Cowards, come on, yes or no? Well, there isn't, you know that. Force causes acceleration, not motion. So your anecdotes, all of you would say, yes, of course there's a force, it's the aeroplane pushing me forward. It's false. So anecdote, I'm afraid, will not do. And I can give you millions of examples. I'm terribly sorry, that's not impressed. Also, when Rupert says 186 papers were published in the scientific literature, which scientific literature? The parapsychology literature. Now, I'm not snobbish. Yes, I am. Of course I'm snobbish. What am I pretending? If it were in the British Journal of Psychology or Science or Nature or the Transactions of the Royal Society, I would take it much more seriously. And if it were a real phenomenon, these journals would publish it. There's no question about it. What's in it for us? Why should we scientists be worried that telepathy exists, even though we can't explain it? You know, we don't really understand quantum mechanics. I've got a quotation here from famous physicists saying, yes, quantum mechanics works. We don't really understand it. This is one of the things that we have to live with, and we'll try and investigate it. And what I keep coming back to is that people like Rupert who work on this make zero attempt to understand what's happening. They don't want to know how big the effect is. They don't want to know if they can confuse it. They don't know what barriers you could put in the way to prevent these thoughts being transferred. So it's all just a nice spiritual exercise to make one really feel better. And when we come to the child-mother one, you know, the chance I'd need to look at those statistics, because I would once again have to argue that the chance of coincidence there is extreme. Just let me give you, you go into a room, yes? Do you not think it's remarkable that in a small group of people, very often two of you have the same birthday? Do you not find that? Would you find that? Do you know how many people you need in a room in order for the probability of two of you to have exactly the same birthday is 1/2? Bet you don't know. 23. So if you want to make money, go to groups of 50 and bet evens that there are two people in that room who have exactly the same birth date, you'll make a fortune. You only need 23. If you don't believe me, take any who's who you like, as I've done with students, and just let them randomly write down the birth dates of the people. How many do they have to go through on average before they find two with the same birth date? 23. Coincidence can be much more surprising than you would imagine. I think that example of the child and the mother, where the child, you know, could actually get the exact numbers, I think one would have to look at that in a very, I mean, that is a remarkable example, but one would have to look at it in much more detail. And why did they not make any effort to find out what was going wrong, or going right, as it were? So it's all lovely stories, which I regret to say leave me unpersuaded totally that there is something called extrasensory perception. Sorry.
Well, Rupert?
Well, I noticed that when the Parrot film was showing, Lewis wasn't looking at it, and that film was shown on television in an early stage of our investigations. He did the same then. They asked a skeptic to commentate. Lewis appeared on the screen and he said, "Telepathy is just junk. There is no evidence whatsoever for any person, animal or thing being telepathic." The filmmakers were surprised that he hadn't actually asked to see the evidence before he commented on it. And I think this is rather like the Cardinal Bellarmine and people not wanting to look through Galileo's telescope. I think we have a level here of just not wanting to know, which is not real science. I'm sorry to have to say it, Lewis. Let me come to his specific points. He said that in relation to in the telephone experiments, we didn't bother to find out the effects of distance. Yes, we did. If you read the paper, we deliberately recruited people in England who had relatives living in Australia and New Zealand and South Africa. We've tested it at distances right up to the Antipodes, precisely to find out, is it distance dependent? It's not. Distance had no effect. We looked at other variables, familiar versus unfamiliar people. As you'll remember, I think telepathy happens with familiar people, but not unfamiliar ones. And here, when we compare the results of familiar, could we have the familiar and unfamiliar people? You'll see that with the familiar people, the result was about 53%, massively significant. The unfamiliar ones were at the chance level. There was a guessing bias. People said the names of familiar people more than unfamiliar ones. When you correct for that, these are the results. It's still, however, very significant, this difference between familiar and unfamiliar people. So that's in the telephone and the email telepathy things, we are actually looking at just these variables. They're all in these published papers you're welcome to take home with you afterwards. Now, when we come to the case of the psychic dog, JT, the dog that belongs to Pam Smart, who's here this evening, what we found in our experiments was that the dog, here are some averages from these experiments, the dog, these are 10-minute periods after Pam went out. These are the number of seconds at the window evaluated from the videotape by a third party who knew nothing else about the experiment. They're an objective measure of the time it went to the window. That is the first 10 minutes of her homeward journey from at least 5 miles away. These are medium-length experiments, and these are short ones. The dog did sometimes go to the window when she wasn't coming home to bark at passing cats or look at commotions or disturbances outside or people arriving in cars. But it went to the window far more when she was on the way home, and it started waiting in the 10 minutes before she started off home, when she decided to come home or when she got a random signal on a pager to go home. It was highly significant that it was at the window most when she was on the way home. And it wasn't just that it waited a certain time and then went there, because in these short experiments, you see, it was at the window a long time, whereas at the same time after she went out here, it wasn't. These results are highly significant, highly repeatable. We've done lots of them. The case of Richard Wiseman and his colleagues is a very interesting one. Wiseman is one of Britain's leading media skeptics. He's an informed skeptic in the sense he reads the literature and knows what's going on, and he actually does experiments. However, he is a very committed skeptic who believes these things are basically impossible. And Wiseman went along to do these experiments with Pam Smart. He invented a criterion for the success or failure of the dog, which was that it should go to the window for no reason apparent to Wiseman for 30 seconds. No, the first experiment it was 60 seconds, then he changed the criterion to be 2 minutes for no apparent reason. If the dog went to the window for no apparent reason when she wasn't coming home, it failed the test. He published a paper in the British Journal of Psychology saying it had failed the test. There's the paper. He put out a press release. It was in all the science correspondents of most of our broadsheet newspapers are committed skeptics, most of them. They're very credulous when it comes to claims of skeptics. The papers were full of it. Psychic dog fails test. Psychic dog fails to give scientists a lead. And so on. It was on the radio, it was on the television, the whole phenomenon was totally refuted, and everybody bought it, who wants to believe that. And we've heard from Lewis a categorical statement. However, if you plot Richard Wiseman's data on a graph, which he didn't do in his paper, even though I sent him graphs before he submitted it, showing what they looked like, this is what they look like. These are objective data. I've looked at the videotapes he has. There's no dispute about the facts. Here they are on the graph. They show exactly the same pattern as my own data, the ones Pam and I observed. Here, the first 10 minutes of the homeward journey, the dog is at the window a great deal more than it's at any other time. This effect is statistically significant at the 1% level. The arrows indicate the times where he judged the dog to have failed the test. Having failed the test, he then discarded the rest of the data and considered them irrelevant to his analysis. We've had a dispute about this in the literature, backwards and forwards. He adamantly sticks to the idea that once they've failed a test according to the criterion he established, the rest of the data are irrelevant. Almost everybody else who's actually seen the data thinks that this is exactly the same pattern as we observed. The dog does indeed go to the window when Pam's not on the way home, as he did in our own experiments. But on average, the dog was at the window 4% of the time when she wasn't coming home and 78% of the time when she was. So here we have another sociological aspect of this phenomenon, that when you do get results, when they are replicated, for those who don't want to believe them, there'll be a distortion both in the reporting of the results and a heavy distortion in the media. Why aren't they published in leading journals? We submitted our paper. He sent it to the British Journal of Psychology. We submitted ours to the British Journal of Psychology. It was rejected. It was rejected on the grounds that there weren't enough data the first time round. We then submitted it with 100 tests. He had 3. It was then submitted on the grounds that they couldn't publish it because it was going to be published in a book of mine that was due to come out 5 months later, and they couldn't publish things published elsewhere. Wiseman's paper had been published 2 years before, exactly the same, in the proceedings of the Parapsychological Association. So if you make the argument, there's, why isn't it in the journals, the answer is, editors don't want this stuff to be there. I then submitted it to Animal Behavior, this work on the dog, the leading journal in the animal behavior world. The editor sent it back by return of post saying, I don't want to waste your time and ours. No referee for this journal would consider a paper that mentions the word telepathy. So we have a self-reinforcing system here that Lewis is very much part of, as when he was chairman of the now disbanded Committee on the Public Understanding of Science. He could speak with a great authority, seeming authority on these matters. He doesn't believe it. Most people don't believe it. It's not in the top journals. It's all junk. It's all pathological science. But the fact is, this is a self-reinforcing system, reinforced by a system of taboos and prejudices, which I think are a shame to science. I think that this is an outrage, really, that in a scientific world we have this kind of behaviour going on, which I think brings discredit on the whole of science. And I think one of the things that really disillusions people with science is the feeling that science is not actually about evidence, it's about dogma. And my view is that science needs to be about evidence, not dogma. And personally, I see telepathy as a test case for this very principle.